The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, as we go forward, what we're going to do in the next several minutes in our lecture is I want to introduce a little bit about the idea of British or English Puritan ethics. We talked about the English Reformation, the Scottish Reformation when we were together. And as we wrestled with that, one of the things that I said is that we would come back to talk a little bit about the Assembly and its theology. Some of the distinctives that came out of the Assembly are, first of all, a thoroughgoing federal or covenantal theology, and secondly, a very strong ethical system that is based upon the law of Scripture. Those are two things we want to talk about in our time together. So as we talk about the idea of the covenantal structure, let's keep in mind some basic distinctions. Everybody who studies the Bible talks about the covenant, because the covenant's in the Bible. It comes up many, many times. Covenant theology is difficult to define, but one way we could certainly define it is that it emphasizes the continuity of the Bible from Old to New Testament because of this notion of the relationship of God and man, that it becomes the theological hermeneutic of unity of the Testaments or the Old and New Testament revelations. To make a distinction between a covenantal theology and a federalism, we now are moving beyond a hermeneutical tool of unification to a conscious construction of a theological grid that sees God's covenants as somehow explaining how theology works. And specifically, we mean the union of a pre-fall or pre-lapsarian covenant along with a post-lapsarian covenant of grace, so that there becomes something of a dialectic of covenant in the structure of theology of redemption. And that's what generally we mean when we use the word federal theology. It's fascinating that the Westminster Assembly establishes a federal theology in a confessional structure. The other creeds and confessions of the Reformation do not require a pre-lapsarian covenant. They did not have them. The Westminster Assembly does. So that you will find in a very fascinating way within the Reformed tradition, there are those who believe that this is a necessary theological idea to say God made a covenant with Adam that begins the process of redemption. And there are others who look at that and say that is an addition to the historic, primal, reformational, reformed understanding. It's unnecessary, or perhaps it's even damaging to the theology of the early Reformation. So you'll discover that the federal issue is a foundational question. Now, just to connect the two issues I'm talking about, when you begin to develop an ethic that's based upon law, you obviously are getting into the arena of how does this law that people are to live in their Christian life, how does that relate to the original covenant? Is it the same law? Is it a different law? Is the Ten Commandment structure of Sinai that becomes a model for a Christian ethic in a legal kind of ethic of the British Reformation consistent with a pre-fall revelation of God's nature given to Adam? So that's a fascinating parallel. So these two questions are related. A very strong emphasis on the law is the foundation for ethics, and the question of the role of God and man, Adam and God, in the pre-fall economy, which was violated. And how does that law relate to the two? So there's a connection between the two questions. Let's say just a little bit about how the development of the covenant of works comes into place. First of all, the nomenclature of this pre-fall covenant is confusing because you have people who will describe it as a covenant of works, meaning Adam had to actually do certain works, such as obey God in the garden, to keep the garden, to obey the prohibition, to not eat of the fruit of the tree, all the other things that would be implicit in that arrangement. Those works, in a certain sense, had a merit, potentially, that God was going to reward him for his obedience. Okay, that's one possible structure, and you could emphasize the language of the covenant of works. Others like the language, the covenant of creation, meaning that in creation, God entered into an arrangement with Adam, and that this now is not necessarily suspended upon obedience primarily. Okay, so that's a model. A third name for this covenant, this prelapsarian covenant, is the covenant of life, meaning that the consequences of continuing in the covenant was an extended life arrangement. Others have called it the covenant in Eden to not prejudice the question and just say it's there. Biblical theologians have wrestled with the fact, can you call something a covenant when the covenant language is not present? So you'll find people who would say, well, we shouldn't even use the word covenant, such as John Murray, who was at Westminster, as you know, in its early years, said we should call it the Adamic administration and not even use the word covenant because it's not biblically appropriate. Now, in these different models, historically, the question has come up, where do we first find the emergence of the covenant of works that now is present in the confession at Westminster? The confession of faith in the English Reformation makes it a confessional idea. It's not present in the earlier creeds. So the question of the origin of it is a fascinating one, and let me just suggest a few possible lines of where it may have emerged. Continental scholars typically suggest it's a result of Philip Melanchthon's influence on the Reformed theologians, that he pushed onto them because of his close relationship through the crypto-Calvinistic controversy, a relationship that began to develop, and he brought into that the law-gospel distinction, and the Reformed tradition had to figure out somehow to implement it. And this is the way it came out, that they said, we will have a law-gospel distinction, even though we see covenant continuity, and they made it between the before the fall and after the fall, the covenant of law at the beginning, and then the covenant of grace to follow thereafter. That's one explanation that has been offered. Another explanation that has been offered is that this is really an implicit idea that was already present in Calvin's theology, and it begins to unfold. It is significant that the first person to develop clearly the language of the covenant of creation are Ursinus and Olivianus. They are the co-authors of the Heidelberg Catechism, German Reformed theology. What's important here is that in their confession, or their creed, or let's say, excuse me, the catechism that they composed before the Heidelberg Catechism, they actually included the language of the covenant of creation and included in it the Ten Commandments of God as part of that arrangement. That did not survive when they came to the Heidelberg Catechism. It was not included. But their earlier form of their catechism had this. So the first clear use of a covenant of creation language comes up immediately in the successors of Calvin. These are Calvin's students. So that argues that the roots of it may well have been in Calvin. There are other people who view it as an implicit idea that is beginning to emerge because there is a need to explain the problem of God's sovereignty in his decree over against the general call of the gospel. So the problem of how do we explain the sovereign decree of God to save some when they're not yet fallen? How do we keep God's justice in view? So one suggestion is this is part of the intralapsarian debate that's developing. Now, what do we mean by that? Basically, how do we preserve God's justice if he is choosing a people and it's eternally a decree and sin has not even entered into history? Well, the answer is that God somehow started out with a universal offer of the gospel to everybody in Adam and that there is a sense of generality to everyone. And that Adam's fall is the basis out of which God had envisioned the future election of a people. And so that God is just because the people are fallen. God is just in offering the gospel to everybody in Adam in a conditional form. If they had kept it, all would have been saved. So that there's both a universality and a particularity at work. And that therefore the reason for the covenant of works is to preserve God's justice, kind of in the infralapsarian debate, and his graciousness to all men, even though it's conditional, because the covenant of works is providing life to everybody if they had obeyed it, the conditional issue. Now, however you look at all those theories, and it's not our purpose to critique them in this survey class, you can see it's a confused area with many explanations. The fundamental issue for us is that there is within the Reformed tradition a love-hate relationship with the pre-fall covenant. So you will find working out of the Reformation those who are in the Presbyterian tradition who really love this, and those outside the Presbyterian tradition who have not accepted the Westminster Assembly's language and say this is a confusion. More lately, just so you can see how it works out, there are those who would see it as a legalism that must be expunged from Calvin's theology. This would be the view of Karl Barth in his system. that the pre-fall covenant is an intrusion of law into the gracious arrangement that God had made with Adam. And therefore, in much the same way that the Puritans developed a legalistic ethic in life, we must return to a grace focus. So you see these two issues of the law for the life and the law in the creational order are viewed as somehow antithetical to grace. Now that's part of the background. Now, how do those who are friendly to the covenant of works view this whole issue? Basically, it would be as follows, that there is the notion that law is an expression of grace. Remember we talked about Zwingli, who said the law is the gospel, that this is a good gift of God. No, man can't be saved by doing it now that he's fallen. But it was a gracious gift from the beginning that man would know how to live for God, to walk with God, and find a relationship that would please God. It is gracious. It is not antithetical. So in the Reformed tradition, you will find some in biblical theology to this day who will say the covenant of works is a covenant where merit was included, and they would emphasize that if Adam had kept it, he would have been rewarded with life. There are others who would say, no, you cannot emphasize merit at all at any point in God's arrangement, and it was just simply a gracious work. And you have both schools that are out. That's part of the debate between Meredith Klein and John Murray, if you've been studying that biblical theology. That's still alive to this day, and it goes back in its historical roots. Okay, so at any rate, what we need to see then is that the covenant of works emerges directly in the context of Calvin's successors. I think the Melanchthonian argument is fairly weak, in my opinion. But whatever you do with it, it now is creedal. It is also significant in the ongoing federal developments that the German Reformed theologians, Olevianus and Ursinus, are also the first to propose a pretemporal covenant, that is, between the Father and the Son in an eternity past. You may remember the high priestly prayer of Jesus in John chapter 17, where he says, Father, I have fulfilled your work, now glorify your Son. And there seems to be this idea of, I've done what you've asked me to do, I'm now asking you to do what you promised for me. There's a sense in the incarnation of fulfillment of what had been planned. Okay, this idea of a pre-temporal covenant between the Father and the Son is something that Jonathan Edwards will pick up very fully in his work, The History of Redemption. It'll become a standard part of many Reformed theologians' thinking. Please note that that most full form of federalism is not at any point mandated by any confession in the Reformed tradition. That is now an intramural discussion that goes beyond it. So if you think about it this way, the three theological covenants of federalism, all the Reformed tradition maintains the covenant of grace. Only the Westminster Standard tradition and some following after maintain the requirement of the prelapsarian covenant of works, covenant of life, or covenant of creation, or Edenic covenant, whatever you call it, and the covenant of grace. No confession requires the idea of a pretemporal covenant between the Father and the Son, although many Reformed theologians teach it, but you'll find many who disagree with it as well. So covenant theology is simultaneously the distinctive character of the Reformed heritage, and it's also one of its greatest intramural rivalry points, okay, that covenantal theologians are still skirmishing over these issues to this very day. The Reformation was not univocal on the issue of the covenant, okay? Now let's stop for some questions on that. That's just a quick survey of the waterfront as to how did we get that. It came in the English Reformation. How did the English get it? Well, remember, they were drinking deeply from the waters of the Swiss Reformation. That's how it came over. The German Reformed theology and the Swiss Reformation introduced the covenant. It came to England. The Puritan movement saw it, espoused it, and developed it. Yes, question. Well, I'd ask you to read my dissertation, and you'll hear my view very fully. I believe Calvin actually develops a proleptic prelapsarian covenant. I think there's data to demonstrate that in five or six key passages, and then in the entire hallmark of his thinking, it's a natural flow. I would not say he taught a covenant of works, but there is the concept present. Probably the most graphic point for me is that while Calvin believes there's no merit in any covenant, that's very clear. He would be on the side of kind of like the John Murray position that says, let's don't talk about merit in the covenant. Turretin will talk about merit in the covenant. Okay, Turretin's a great Reformed theologian, so there's a debate here in this prelapsarian economy. Calvin, I don't think, is willing to do that at any point in his thinking, but he does say that the law is made for the sinner, according to Paul in 1 Timothy 1. He said, so what do we do with the fact that we're teaching that the law is present here in the garden? And he will explain that in such a way that allows for a gracious use of the law in the garden. So there, all the kind of things that would be important for a person who maintains a covenant of works are present in Calvin's exposition in his commentary. He will, in fact, at least twice in his writings refer to God's covenant with Adam. So he actually uses that language. And one of those passages very consciously refers to a pre-fall situation. And he speaks of the tree of life as the sacrament of God's covenant with Adam. And Calvin says there is no sacrament where there is no covenant. That's the standard rule of his thinking. So there has to be a covenant with Adam. There has to, because there's a sacrament with Adam. It's the tree of life. And so at that point, we can see there is an incipient covenantal thinking that's at work. And there's no accident in my mind that Ursinus will be the first to articulate it in a catechism. And you remember the Luther conversion story I told you about? There's a fascinating Ursinus conversion story. He was actually out in a boating episode, and the boat sank, and he was out swimming in the water, and he made a covenant with the Lord. Now, he was reformationally influenced now, so he wasn't going to cry out to St. Anne. He cries out to God and says, "Lord, if you spare my life, I promise I will commit myself to studying the writings of John Calvin." That's true. That's a true story. Ursinus will become the seminary president of the theological school at Heidelberg. He is influenced by Melanchthon in some ways. We know he studied under Melanchthon's writings, but it's fascinating that Ursinus consciously saw himself as Reformed and studied Calvin's writings, and he's the first to articulate these doctrines. I think that's where he got them from. So I have a historical leg to stand on as well as some theological evidence, but I want to make sure you understand that this is not a fundamental component, but the seeds are there, and I think they sprout up in the next generation. So I would argue that there are incipient forms of a prelapsarian covenant in Calvin. I think the Melanchthonian influences all fall apart when they're critiqued in historical context. I wrote an article in the Westminster Journal way back in 1981 that actually deals with this issue. If you want to go back and dig that up, it's called The Covenant of Creation, a Debt to Melanchthon or Calvin or something like that. So you can read that if you'd like. Okay, yes, sir. Okay, well, it's fascinating. In the dispensational system of critique, you know, there's been this historic American rivalry between covenantal theology and dispensationalism. The dispensationalists have typically said, well, you know, you always say dispensationalism is so late in developing. It's only Coxeas who first develops covenant theology, and he's in the 1600s. So, you know, we're beginning dispensationalism, hints of it, in the 1700s. So we're not that late. So in that debate, it's fascinating that Coxeas, in many people's minds, is consciously identified as being the first covenantal theologian. Well, obviously, I'd reject that whole notion going back to Zwingli and Bullinger that there's, in fact, we could go back into the ancient church with Augustine if we really wanted to, but that's for another topic or class. But I think what Coxeas is important is that in the theology of the Dutch Reformed schools, there began to be a debate between Macovius, who was a very strong, logical, kind of Aristotelian scholastic thinker, and then the biblical theologians that followed more in the Coxean stream. So even to this day, you get a biblical theologian and a systematic theologian together, and you recognize their methods create tensions because they want to go at it very differently between them. Coxeas was a biblical type theologian, and I think the other tradition of Macovius was much more of a scholastic theology, so that there was a tension. He developed a very conscious biblical covenantal theology. Okay, now he doesn't do it exactly the way that Voss will, but he's a precursor of the Vossian covenantal biblical theology. I think what Coxeas is most important for is that he developed a very unique theology where he explained all of the rest of theology from the fall as an abrogation of the covenant of works. So it's a fascinating approach. He said God established a creational order with the covenant of works. And now everything since that's been damaged, that order had to be assessed and reappraised by God in his gracious work, so that all the subsequent covenantal developments are in some way addressing the fouling up of that covenant by Adam, so that it's being abrogated in each way by different successive issues. So it's a fascinating model. So what I think makes Coxeas unique is the biblical covenantal focus and his unique twist of the abrogations of the covenant of works and the covenant of grace. But he himself did not invent covenant theology as alleged to downplay predestinarianism. He himself is very clear in his book on the covenant. I'm an infralapsarian, he says. So, by the way, Coxeas is yet to be translated into English. So if we have any good Dutch or Latin scholars out there, that's one of the classic works that needs to be made available. Okay. So his importance is for putting a very biblical theological construction on it. And he clearly held to a covenant of works and a covenant of grace. But it was the dialectic between the two that made his very unique. But we can find this pre-fall covenant much earlier, all the way back in Ursinus, Levianus, hints of it in Calvin, in my opinion. Okay, yes, sir. I think all the Reformed tradition believe that election happened in eternity. Well, let's put it this way. I had the opportunity to write an article on Peter Martyr and Genesis 17, and because Genesis 17 is the basis of Zwingli and Bullinger's development. And I am fascinated by the fact that he does not have the same sort of covenantal primacy that these men do. He has his own model. As far as I can tell, he doesn't make any hints about a prelapsarian covenant, as far as I can tell. Now, his work on Genesis is being translated even as we speak, so we can get a closer look at it here in the next year or so. But as far as I know, he does not develop a prelapsarian covenant. And that when he does emphasize the covenant in Genesis 17, he puts the sacramental language as primary. So that if we think that, if Calvin says wherever there is a covenant, there will be a sacrament, I think it's kind of like the other way. The emphasis for Martyr is that if there's a sacrament, there will be a covenant. He is a sacramental theologian at the highest level. That's the focus that he wants. And it's especially with circumcision in Genesis 17 that he has a very extended scholia in his commentary that deals with the sacramental theology. So he doesn't see it so primarily in the creational order, although Calvin will include that. So I think Calvin is stronger at this point than Martyr in my primitive reading of the data there. Yes. There are other questions? Yes. Okay. What I'm doing is making just a terminological distinction. Obviously, the word federal means covenantal. It could be a synonym. I'm using it with a nuance to suggest there's those who hold the idea of the covenant because it's biblical. Covenant theology, primarily, that is the hermeneutical continuity of Old to New Testament, that the Bible is one book united in God's dealing in Christ. Federal theology is being reserved in this discussion to emphasize that there was also a prelapsarian covenant that somehow stands in tension or in continuity with the covenant of grace. Okay, so that it's the prelapsarian covenant and the covenant of grace that together create federalism. So covenant theology believes in the covenant of grace. There's this one gracious dealing of God in all of history, from Old to New Testament. Federalism, as I'm using the term now, emphasizes, no, there are two covenants, one before the fall, and then the covenant of grace that addresses it. And then I'm using federalism in its most developed form to suggest the idea of an intra-Trinitarian pactum salutis, a pre-temporal covenant between the Father and the Son in eternity past. Okay. Yes, we would certainly want to say that, because as you think through how covenant theology will begin to explain the issues, they will move from an Augustinian realism in original sin to a federalism that says Adam sinned as the head of the human race. It's not that we were in Adam's loins, like Augustine argued, and therefore we have original sin. It's rather he was the head of our relationship, of our covenant. And in his fall, all of us fell in him. So now Christ comes as the second Adam to take up the very same covenant of works, and he fulfills it at every point. And if we stand in Christ by divine election, then as our covenant head, we are right. And that moves then into a very rich discussion about what's called the active and passive obedience of Christ. Does Christ obey the law for himself so that he could become the covenant head? Or does he in fact obey the law as the substitute for the others who went before to fulfill their failure, their sin, and so that he can impute that covenantal obedience onto them as their justification righteousness? So you can see, how do you explain the active obedience of Christ? Is it necessary for him to qualify? Or is it rather, it's what he is doing to give to his people, or both? And then you have others who say, well, the act of obedience of Christ, if it was only intended for him to qualify, is not what redeems us or justifies us. It's really his passive obedience, simply his suffering on the cross, bearing the wrath of God. So you can see, the greater the role you place of the prelapsarian covenant, the more important becomes Christ's obedience to become ours, because we are justified in the covenant of works, but through a mediator. So is there one covenant? Well, no, because if there's only one covenant, then the one covenant said you stand in Adam and you're lost. See, if you're going to dissolve them into one, you have a problem, because the first covenant did not provide a mediator. It did not provide redemption. It simply provided a reward for perseverance. If you persevere, you'll be established in righteousness. The covenant of grace says, no, you can't persevere because you already started as a sinner. You need a mediator who has persevered, and now you stand in him and have grace. So that they're very closely concatenated logically here, but they are in fact distinct. So I don't think you can make them one. Now you can certainly attempt to unite them very strongly in terms of grace, that they're all gracious. And that makes them very, very, very much one and the same. But the difference is that there is no sin in view in the first covenant. In the second covenant, there's a fall in view. In the first covenant, there's no provision of a mediator. The second covenant, there is. So there has to be some distinction, even though you can draw them very, very close together and tie them in grace. It would be hard to say they're one and the same, unless you want to just talk of the plan of God, but then the covenant is different. Okay, so I would have a hard time identifying them as one and the same. Well, the two things. First of all, I didn't say it's based on works, although some do. See, my position I'm not maintaining yet, because this isn't a theology class. I'm just trying to represent different viewpoints, okay? My understanding is that those who would argue that it was an action based upon a reward, the grace is that there was no obligation for God to have made a covenant at all. The very fact that there is such an opportunity for relationship is an act of grace. God could have created his creatures and not given them any opportunity to be in relationship with him. So the fact that a covenant exists is an expression of grace. And then in this system, the idea that the law's presence in the covenant is the law and grace model, that law and grace are not ultimately antithetical, that grace provides for law as well. Now, can you have then kind of a merit in that system? This is where those who would critique that model would say, well, that sure sounds like medieval congruism of some sort. You know, that God is saying, well, it's a gracious merit. You know, it's a meritum de congruo almost. And so that would be a critique. And then the answer, no, it's different because these are perfect men. They're not fallen. So it's not meritum de congruo because their sin is not in view yet here. These are moral creatures. So the nuances become very fascinating at that point. But you could see it could be viewed as very much an act of grace because of the condescension of the Creator to the creature to enter into a relationship of continuity, even though it is one that includes law. But it's possible, theoretically, because to use one of these words, the protoplast, the first man, was not a fallen being. He was righteous. He had a pure nature. So therefore, he was given a gracious opportunity to persevere in the estate in which he was created. Okay, yes. That's the fundamental idea that's view. And I think all the Reformed tradition is going to emphasize the mutuality in some measure, whereas I think the Lutheran model will move more in that testamentary direction where it's more God to man, and man is just the passive recipient of it. The covenantal nuance in the Reformed tradition says God is always primary, he always takes the initiative, but it is a relationship that is mutual to which man responds. In grace, of course, but he does respond. It is a true God begins and we respond to him. I would say he's defining it in a biblical theological model. He's saying that a covenant, first of all, since it's not expressly declared, we should be careful to impose that concept of a later time. Biblical theology is prepared to say it's the organic development of biblical truth. And if you read an idea that's not been introduced back into the past, you destroy the exegesis. You're distorting it in some way. So don't read it in there. I think Murray would understand that covenant, if it's distinctively gracious, he would say, well, that the grace element is one of the foundational questions. Let me step back and put it this way. In one of Murray's works, he argues that the paradigm for the covenant ought to be the Noahic experience rather than Genesis 17. So he would say it is God who establishes this sign in the skies. God does all this, and he says, this is my promise, you do nothing but receive it. So Murray is moving in a testamentary direction, kind of like Luther here. I think it's fascinating. He so wants to emphasize grace at this point that he is going to kind of bring a Lutheran type approach to the covenant and focus on, no, he's very unique in that. There's no one else who's ever done that in Reformed history. This is where Murray steps out in his own territory. He says, I like Noah's covenant, and it's a testamentary character rather than a true covenantal mutuality character at that point. That it's a one-sided bequeathment, that God makes the promise. See, a promise emphasizes what the person who speaks is going to do regardless of the recipient. Relationship by, let's say, mutual relationship, because relationship is ambiguous in a certain sense. Right? That there's not the reciprocity. Murray certainly is going to call for reciprocity, but in redemption, he so wants to emphasize the monergism of God's act that he's afraid of, to use a strong word there, of confusing that monergism with any kind of mutuality. The Reformed tradition is not afraid of mutuality, that mutuality is possible and it subsists in grace. So the primal covenantal theology really has a two-sided arrangement, and Calvin will use the word mutual all the time. I mean, it's a constant theme he'll pick up, as well as Bullinger. Okay. So these are nuances of emphasis that we're hitting. Okay, other questions? We've hit a live chord on covenant, I can see. Anybody else have any other questions, comments? All right. As we finish up this kind of a segment, then, I think conditionality or mutuality is a fundamental tension point in the covenantal thinking to this day. I had an opportunity, I think, in 1995 to write an article on the mutuality and conditionality of the covenant in Calvin. I think it's called The Continuing Conundrum or some title like that. It was in the Calvin Theological Journal. If you'd like to look that up. I kind of wrestle with the debates on how do we look at the early reformers in terms of, is there a real mutuality or is it a one-sided thing? And it is a tough point. But these early Reformed theologians were open and emphasized mutuality. And then as you look at the development intramurally of covenant theology, you'll find some that will say there are two conditions of the covenant of grace, faith and repentance. You'll have some that say, no, there's only one condition of the covenant, it's faith. You'll have others who say, let's don't use conditionality at all because it seems to bring in merit or some type of human response. And so I keep coming back to the famous dictum of Calvin that what is subordinate is not contrary, that human mutuality is subordinate to God's monergism, so it's not a my merit versus God's work. It's something that's implicit and subordinate to it, but necessary. It will, in fact, occur. So we have to break from the logical equivalence of the two to a subordination, and then you understand Calvin's thought. That's what he's got. There is a conditionality, but it's subordinate in grace. It's still God's working, but it manifests itself in a real faith and a real obedience. And for Calvin, the covenant has two parts, and they both reflect the conditions. Faith for justification, a new obedience, a regeneration, a renovation of life that's seen by a changed character, that they both are there. All of grace, but they're there. And so you can see how that will work out in the different models as we go forward in history. Okay, now, as we kind of wrap this part up, I said the second question about the Westminster Assembly's theology I wanted to at least hit on in the reformational setting that makes it somewhat unique is that in the larger catechism, there becomes the most extensive discussion of ethics of any Reformed creed or catechism. The larger catechism is just filled with a very deep exposition of the Ten Commandments. It seems to bring all of the demands of and teaching of Christian life under the rubric of each of the commands. And that's a unique, distinct contribution of this Puritan ethic. There is a connection. I'm not going to say it's a direct cause, but there is a connection between the emphasis of the law in paradise in the pre-lapsarian covenant and the law in the life of the believer. Here's the great proof. The Sabbath. The Sabbath was based upon the creational order. The Ten Commandments reestablished the Sabbath. The New Covenant writes the law upon the heart. The same law that was at creation, the same law at Sinai, is now upon the believer's heart. And so that the Sabbath becomes, in the English setting, an expression of the eternal work of God's holy law that is gracious in character. Graciously given at the beginning, graciously even given to Moses, and now graciously being written upon the heart of the believer. You see the continuity. That's the classic example of the continuity. In fact, some of the Reformed theologians will begin to emphasize that in the pre-lapsarian covenant, one of the signs and seals or the sacraments is the Sabbath. They would say the Sabbath, along with the tree of life, are the two sacraments of God's covenant with Adam before the fall. Sabbath keeping is a sign of that covenant. And it still continues on to this day as it's been carried along in its new tradition. Now, John Murray, in his classic work on principles of conduct, will develop a wonderful phrase called the creation ordinances. I don't know if you've had opportunity to read that work yet, but along the way you certainly should. And what he's doing is capturing the Puritan understanding of how the law was at work in the pre-lapsarian setting, and that there are certain things built into the fabric of reality that carry with them the force of law as God's gracious gift to his people. Now, how does that work out? Well, for example, Jesus, when he's having the great debate about marriage and divorce, what does he do? He appeals to the creation. He says, it was not so at the beginning. He says, what God did at the beginning in creation was to give us a design that is inherently moral, and it has the force of law, because it reflects God's character. What God did is the same as God speaking at Sinai. He gave us a law. So that, by the way, one of the most incontestable arguments in the classic debate with the homosexual discussion in the church is the creation ordinance. What was God's intent and design at the beginning? You know, you may try to get out of all the exegetical meanderings, but it's very difficult to leave behind. If you contain the notion of your thinking of a creation ordinance in place, heterosexual monogamy was an expression of God's idealism. This is God's model. Okay, that was before the fall. It's what God holds up for his people. Or that's an ethical kind of discussion. But what I want you to see here is that Jesus warrants the notion of going back to the creational model for a standard of ethics. Okay, that idea of the Sabbath, of marriage, how about this? Adam was called to till the garden. So that labor is part of that. Labor, marriage, Sabbath. We think of the idea of procreation and building the family. It says be fruitful and multiply. The idea of actually subduing the earth, that is the whole arena of the cultural mandate, as we might call it today, of man using his mind, his energy, and work to bring even greater order out of God's ordered world. That is a new higher order than what is naturally present, to subdue it, to not to rape it, not to destroy it, but to tame it. And so that the cultural mandate now is a demand, that is to go out and subdue the earth to God's glory. We're going to come back in our second lecture and take a little bit of time and talk more about how this is worked out in the larger catechism as they take these ethical principles. But while we wrap up, just what I want you to hear then is that what Murray is doing in the principle of conduct is making far more explicit what I think was the fundamental understanding of the English Puritans in their reformational creed, where they said, we go back to creation and we see God's law at work in his covenant. And remember, in Reformed theology, the Mosaic covenant is an expression of the covenant of grace. So when the law is given at Sinai, it is an expression of grace. There's law and grace. So that at the creational order, while works are important, it's still a gracious gift of law, and that order at the beginning carries over into the Old Testament and as well into the New. And therefore, there is an unbroken thread of ethical continuity from the first covenant through the Old Covenant to the New Covenant. And then that brings out the idea, what I try to say, what does the catechism say about the law in the believer's life? That is the law in grace model, fully consistent with this covenantal approach as opposed to what we've called the more testamentary approach. You don't find a pre-fall covenant in Lutheranism. They are not worried about that. There are different models at work. This is distinctively Reformed. I want to come back and talk about the larger catechism after a break, so we'll see you in an hour.